By all accounts, Abraham Lincoln was a deeply good person. And as one might expect, he was deeply loved by those who appreciated just how good he was. He was not, to be sure, a perfect person, as if there is such a thing. He abhorred slavery, for example, yet some of his public remarks suggest that he held certain common racial prejudices about the superiority of white people, and like many abolitionists of his day, he at one point favored colonizing outside of the U.S. those persons who had been enslaved. Frederick Douglass found much to criticize about Lincoln's actions and perceived inaction, and he was enraged in particular by the idea of colonization. And their relationship was complicated. Still, Douglass reported after his first meeting with Lincoln at the White House that Lincoln had received him, just as you have seen one gentleman receive another, with a hand and a big voice well balanced between a kind cordiality and a respectful reserve. I tell you, I felt big there. Lincoln evidently did seek out Douglass's advice, and their second meeting came at Lincoln's invitation. The Emancipation Proclamation had not resulted in the mass exodus from rebellious states that Lincoln had expected, and believing that he was going to lose the upcoming election, he sought to enlist Douglass in a scheme to lead a network of individuals into the rebellious states to help as many as possible escape enslavement. The mission proved unnecessary, as it happened, because Lincoln did win re-election. Their third meeting occurred at the White House after Lincoln's second inaugural address. Douglass recounted that, recognizing me before I reached him, he exclaimed so that all around him could hear, "Here comes my friend Douglass. Take me by the hand," he said. "I'm glad to see you. I saw you in the crowd today listening to my inaugural address. How did you like it?" I said, "Mr. Lincoln, I must not detain you with my poor opinion when there are thousands waiting to shake hands with you." "No, no," he said, you must stop a little, Douglass. There is no man in the country whose opinion I value more than yours. I want to know what you think of it." I replied, "Mr. Lincoln, that was a sacred effort." The most stirring bit of that address I'll remind you of here, as it is of a piece with the point that I hope to convey. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see it, gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which we may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. Historian Doris Kearns Goodwin writes that there is no way to penetrate Lincoln's personal feelings about race. There is, however, the fact that armies of scholars meticulously investigating every aspect of his life have failed to find a single act of bigotry on his part. Even more telling is the observation of Frederick Douglass, who would become a frequent public critic of Lincoln during his presidency, that of all men he had met, Lincoln was the first great man I talked with in the United States freely, who in no single instance reminded me of the difference between myself and himself and myself, of the difference of color. These remarks take on additional meaning when one realizes that Douglass had met dozens of celebrated abolitionists, including Wendell Phillips, William Lloyd Garrison, and Salmon Chase. Apparently, Douglass never felt with any of them, as he did with Lincoln, an entire freedom from popular prejudice against the colored race. I begin with these bits of history, and there are more of them to come, because I want to ensure that my claims are not misunderstood. We can acknowledge Lincoln's inconsistencies and moral failings while recognizing that they were not inconsistent with his being deeply good in all the ways that he was. Despite his shortcomings, Lincoln displayed virtues that were in short supply at the time and that seem in even shorter supply today, not only, even if most problematically, among elected officials. These virtues are critical to preserving a flourishing democracy and the rule of law, as well as to sustaining the interpersonal connections that enable us to flourish both as individuals and as citizens. Such matters are, for me, and I hope for you, of vital concern. You may think of this address as a plea for a rebirth of Lincoln virtues, and as I'll suggest, rekindling these virtues, developing them in ourselves and encouraging their development in others, is not only good for democratic self-government, but good for us as individuals. In the not too distant past, we encouraged others, we instructed our children, we aimed ourselves, at least some of us, to be the bigger person. From what I've read about Lincoln and what I'm inclined to infer from his own words, Lincoln actually was the bigger person. But what does that mean? What is it to be the bigger person? Being the bigger person is sometimes described in terms of de-escalating. The bigger person is the person who doesn't raise a conflict to the next level, who doesn't trade insult for insult, and so on. The bigger person is willing to apologize and let things go, to accept disappointments and not allow anger to take over her. If you want to know how to be the bigger person, by the way, WikiHow offers information on four ways to be the bigger person, right? Mostly pertaining to conflict resolution. Now, this much seems correct on at least some understanding of it, but it also seems to me to be focused too narrowly on dealing with conflict and responding to disappointment, while telling us too little about the bigness of the person who is the bigger person. I'm thus inclined to favor a broader picture of what it means to be the bigger person. The bigger person, I suggest, is the person who sees and deals with others charitably, declining to assume the worst about them, or to see them, paraphrasing Bryan Stevenson, as the worst thing they have ever done. Who doesn't take criticism or expressions of anger, even when hurtful or unjust, personally, and as an occasion for striking back, instead trying to understand and learn from the other's concerns. Who is prepared to step back when what it would take to win will leave others feeling diminished and resentful or be positively destructive. Who stands ready not only to accept responsibility, but also to share responsibility, even when sharing responsibility is merited by the role they occupy in at most an attenuated way. In the interest of enabling the responsible actor to better bear the burden of their responsibility, to recover and move forward. The bigger person is someone who makes others feel valued and respected, who thus makes others feel, as Lincoln made Douglas feel, big. This is just a sketch, of course, and a more precise analysis is in order, but I hope what I've said thus far is sufficient to make my proposal clear, that we think of being the bigger person more capaciously as possessing a set of interconnected virtues, virtues that spring from a fundamental generosity in dealing with others. I call the fundamental virtues Lincoln manifested in his dealing with others the Lincoln virtues, not because he alone exemplified them, but because he was an exemplar of them. In what follows, my aim is not to provide an analysis, but to offer a fuller picture of what I have in mind and briefly explain its political, moral, and prudential import. Much of our talk about blame and responsibility concerns third parties. It involves our laying the blame and placing responsibility on others. But our talk also concerns, though unfortunately far less often, our taking the blame and accepting responsibility. President Harry S. Truman famously had a sign on his desk that read, "The buck stops here," with the backside announcing, "I'm from Missouri." As the webpage at the Truman Library helpfully explains, the saying, "the buck stops here," derives from the slang expression, "pass the buck," which means passing the responsibility on to someone else. The latter expression is said to have originated with the game of poker, in which a marker or counter, frequently in frontier days, a knife with a buckhorn handle, was used to indicate the person whose turn it was to deal. If the person did not wish to deal, he could pass the responsibility by passing the buck, as the counter came to be called, to the next player. During the Clinton administration, following the 51-day siege of the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, Attorney General Janet Reno, who had ordered the raid, publicly expressed regret for the resulting 76 deaths and took full responsibility for the tragedy. She did so despite the fact that the FBI had incorrectly told her that children were being abused by the Branch Davidians, something that would have weighed heavily with Reno, who as a Florida state attorney had focused much of her work on child abuse cases. Whatever one might think of her actions or her tenure as attorney general, her acceptance of responsibility seemed like a breath of fresh air, given the tendency of political actors to pass the buck. We admire people who accept responsibility and express frustration with those who make excuses, shift the blame to others, or creatively redescribe their actions, as did Senators Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz on January 6th, following a violent insurrection aimed at thwarting certification of the 2020 vote, when they depicted themselves as merely raising questions after having spent weeks lying about rampant voter fraud and an allegedly stolen election. Accepting responsibility may not seem to be a virtue. It is, after all, just owning up to what one has done, and so doing what one ought. And we should be careful not to blur the distinction between doing one's duty and exhibiting a virtue. But it seems fair to say that the person who pretty unfailingly takes responsibility for what she has done displays a kind of virtue, given the common temptation and the propensity of many in acknowledging her responsibility to try to duck responsibility. She is, after all, honest, and insofar as honesty is a virtue, in acknowledging her responsibility, she displays honesty about what she has done. Now, some may have theoretical reasons for declining to call regularly accepting responsibility a virtue, but for present purposes, it doesn't much matter what the best analysis of a virtue is. She is certainly someone who is someone we would consider to have a good character. And nothing that I mean to say about what I'm calling the Lincoln virtues requires that they be, on the best analysis, genuine virtues. It seems to me that they are virtues in a fairly ordinary sense, so I shall continue to talk about them as such. I've talked about accepting responsibility for what one has done, but sometimes we are at most partly responsible. We might say that the person who accepts responsibility in such a case accepts partial responsibility in that the responsibility is shared with another. This can happen when we act in concert with another, though cases like this still seem to be ones in which we accept responsibility for doing what we have done and thereby do only what we ought to do anyway. In still other cases, however, our responsibility may be at best attenuated so that our accepting responsibility is rather a sharing of responsibility that isn't a matter of what we ought to do anyway. At least doing so doesn't seem to be an ordinary duty. In some cases, we have not ourselves done wrong, at least not directly, but we are the ultimate author, perhaps the unwitting author, of another's mistake or wrongdoing. When President Truman announced that the buck stopped with him, he surely wasn't claiming that he was the one who had made every mistake or committed every error that was done during his administration. The buck stopped with him insofar as, in virtue of his position and authority, those mistakes or wrongs were ultimately attributable to him, and he was ultimately accountable for them. Lincoln, too, seems to have viewed himself as ultimately responsible for the actions and failings of others. As noted earlier, Lincoln was beloved. No doubt his folksy, unpretentious manner had something to do with it, along with his sense of humor and his skill as a storyteller, But he was loved too because of the generosity with which he treated others. This manifested itself in the way he thoughtfully, carefully shared responsibility for the failings of his subordinates to ease the burden of sometimes crushing criticism and soften the blow to their reputations, because, as he seems to have seen it, their failings were ultimately his own. During the Civil War, the House of Representatives had discovered rampant corruption in the War Department, which was led by Simon Cameron, Lincoln's first Secretary of War. The corruption included purchasing diseased horses, rotten food, and malfunctioning weapons. Right? This is not what you want your Secretary of War to be doing, right? The House, understandably and appropriately, voted to censure Cameron for conduct highly injurious to the public service. As Goodwin tells it, Cameron was devastated, knowing that he would never recover from the scandal. Lincoln, however, made a great personal effort to assuage his pain and humiliation. He wrote a long letter to Congress explaining that the unfortunate contracts were spawned by the emergency situation facing the government in the immediate aftermath of Fort Sumter, which Union troops had lost to the rebel army. Lincoln declared that he and his entire cabinet were at least equally responsible with Cameron for whatever error, wrong, or fault was committed. Cameron was so grateful for Lincoln's response that he became a devoted friend. Goodwin notes, he appreciated the courage it took for Lincoln to share the blame at a time when everyone else had deserted him. Now, Lincoln was surely not responsible, at least not directly, for the corruption in the War Department. In fact, Cameron, it turns out, had a history of shady dealings well before his appointment as Secretary of War. But Lincoln was not wholly without responsibility either. After all, he had appointed Cameron. This isn't quite the same as responsibility for Cameron's corruption itself. Still, it happened on his watch. This is the sort of situation in which it would have been easy for Lincoln to duck whatever responsibility he might have had, or in modern parlance, to throw Cameron under the bus. People wouldn't have been much inclined to blame Lincoln himself. You might think that because people would not have been inclined to blame Lincoln, it was easy for him, it's virtually costless, to share responsibility. Lincoln couldn't have known this, though, and in shifting some of the attention from Cameron to himself, he thereby risked opening himself up to scrutiny and criticism that he might otherwise have avoided. But the risk to him was not the issue. Compassion for his subordinates was. There are many examples of Lincoln sharing responsibility in the way that I mean. Sometimes Lincoln did so, allowing wholly undeserving others to save face, such as General George McClellan, whose self-importance and repeated inaction in the face of explicit orders was costly to the Union in loss of troops and squandered opportunities to set back the rebel forces. Lincoln tolerated McClellan's insubordination far too long. Edwin Stanton, whom Lincoln has appointed as Secretary of War to replace Cameron, was driven and single-minded in his work as Secretary of War and could be brusque and overbearing. The war was not going well during the first few years, and Stanton suffered vicious public criticism from the conservative faction of Republicans, in large measure because General McClellan, who had their support, had shifted the blame for his own failures onto Stanton, claiming that, among other things, Stanton had not supplied the additional troops he requested. Goodwin writes, as always, Lincoln refused to let a subordinate take the blame for his own decisions. He insisted that all that Stanton had done in regard to the army had been authorized by him, the president. He offered a public defense of Stanton before a vast crowd gathered on the Capitol steps for a Union meeting, reminding his audience that he was reluctant to speak unless he might produce some good by it. Lincoln declared that something needed to be said, and it was not likely to be better said by someone else, for it was a matter in which we have heard some other person's blame for what I did myself. Addressing the charge that Stanton had withheld troops from McClellan, he explained that every possible soldier available had been sent to the general. The Secretary of War is not to blame for not giving what he had none to give. I believe he is a brave and able man, and I stand here, as justice requires me to do, to take upon myself what has been charged on the Secretary of War. In Stanton's case, Lincoln didn't merely share responsibility, but took responsibility in the face of McClellan's distortions, leading one onlooker to remark, "He is one of the best men God ever created." These episodes raise interesting questions as to when a person shares responsibility with another appropriately, and when she appropriately accepts or takes responsibility for the acts of another. Consider the original example of Cameron and the corruption at the War Department. In one sense, Lincoln's sharing responsibility made good sense when one voluntarily and intentionally assumes a position of ultimate authority, one thereby also assumes the corresponding ultimate responsibility. One assumes the seat at the table where the buck stops. Still, we might think Lincoln assumed too much responsibility. After all, Cameron was clearly a corrupt actor, and in the midst of a civil war, Lincoln could not have been aware of all his machinations. Lincoln nevertheless did share responsibility in a way that enabled Cameron to escape complete humiliation. He didn't simply let him off the hook, though. Thankfully, he replaced Cameron with Stanton, without whom the Union might well have lost the Civil War. We rightly and fairly place responsibility where it may lie, but sharing responsibility may soften how we do so, as it usually did with Lincoln. Now, I can't here develop an account of the appropriateness, the fittingness of either sharing or accepting responsibility for the acts of another, but I can offer what seemed to me to be a couple of reasonable rules of thumb. First, accepting at least partial responsibility is, pro tanto, appropriate when one voluntarily and intentionally assumes a position of final authority. Lincoln was not directly responsible for Cameron's actions, but he did appoint him. He may not have known of Cameron's past shady dealings, but perhaps he should have. Second, accepting responsibility for the actions of another is generally not appropriate when one didn't know, couldn't reasonably have known, and couldn't fairly be expected to know what another was doing, or when another's actions amounted to an unforeseeable betrayal. Yet whatever we say on the score is orthogonal to what interests me, namely the compassion, the generosity Lincoln exhibited in his dealings with others, even those who failed him. We can admire this without agreeing with every manifestation of his generosity. So whatever norms seem appropriate in the end for a person sharing or accepting responsibility for the actions of another, the Lincoln examples suggest, I think, that the moral value of taking responsibility and blame isn't exhausted by its fittingness, or more precisely, its fittingness is one thing, its moral value another, and its moral value needn't depend on its fittingness. Now, I've discussed certain virtues Lincoln exhibited that are part of a broader understanding of what it is to be the bigger person. But Lincoln also, of course, exemplified being the bigger person in the narrower sense discussed earlier. Most famously, he brought his political rivals into his cabinet and managed to form strong bonds with most of them. It's safe to say that few politicians today would do this, and it couldn't have been easy for him. Lincoln's lowly background led many, including Edward Bates, Salmon Chase, and especially William Seward, to underestimate and condescend to him. But there are perhaps less familiar examples. Lincoln suffered many setbacks during his political career, and he was given to bouts of depression. But passage of the Nebraska-Kansas Act, which repealed the Missouri Compromise and opened up the possibility of slavery being extended into the territory that became Kansas, Nebraska, and the two Dakotas, galvanized him. It was 1855, and after winning a seat in the Illinois State Assembly, he quickly declared his candidacy for the Senate. During the vote to select the next U.S. Senator, Lincoln received the votes of the anti-Nebraska Whig members of the legislature, right, the members of his own party. But four anti-Nebraska Democrats held out, unable to bring themselves to vote for a member of the Whig Party. They voted instead for anti-Nebraska Democrat Lyman Trumbull. By the ninth ballot, Lincoln held only 47 of the 51 anti-Nebraska votes needed to win, to Trumbull's four. Realizing that unless he instructed his supporters to switch to Trumbull, the pro-Nebraska Democrat would choose the next senator, Lincoln advised his floor manager, Stephen Logan, to shift his support to Trumbull. Quoting from Goodwin, Logan refused at first, protesting the injustice of the candidate with the much larger vote, giving it to the candidate with the smaller vote. Lincoln was adamant, insisting that if his name remained on the ballot, you will lose Trumbull and myself, and I think the cause in this case, to be preferred to the men. In his inconsolable supporters' view, and I suspect in Lincoln's, this meant the end of his political career. But if Lincoln had any hard feelings about the election, he didn't express them publicly. Gracious in defeat, a smiling Lincoln attended Trumbull's victory party and shook his hand. Lincoln's actions at this difficult moment exhibited his willingness, his eagerness to conciliate when continuing in his quest for office would only have left others resentful and defeated a cause he deeply supported and that he and others had worked so hard for. Whereas Seward and Chase lost friends in their political victories, Lincoln gained them and their later assistance in his defeat. We should notice, too, another critical virtue this incident and others display. Lincoln understood that the cause was bigger than men, bigger than him. His was not a mere conciliation, but a conciliation based on principle. He had the virtue of recognizing that it was not all about him. The moral and political value of the Lincoln virtues is, I hope, obvious. There is, of course, moral value in accepting responsibility for one's own conduct, in owning up. In so doing, one treats the wronged other with concern and respect, acknowledging their status as a being who merits concern and respect. Because truly accepting responsibility requires making amends, one does the moral work of repair. That repair may simply be the fixing of something broken or the replacement of something lost or destroyed, but more deeply, it may also involve the restoration of trust, the repair of a relationship. But beyond accepting responsibility, sharing responsibility in the ways Lincoln did can provide space for others to recover from their mistakes and develop into more responsible moral agents. This is part of what goes on when parents assume responsibility for the actions of their children. Learning how to accept responsibility, as children better can, when much of the burden of responsibility is taken on for them, is a part of how they develop key virtues, including those of honesty and respect for others. In accepting responsibility, when we are not the direct cause of harm or the ones who directly wrong others, we can develop and manifest the generosity and charitable views of others that underpin what is involved in being the bigger person. As a part of learning to accept and also to share responsibility, a person must cultivate certain capacities that are critical to being a well-functioning moral agent more generally. These include capacities for self-awareness and self-reflection, for sympathy, care, and respect, for seeing and feeling things as if from the other's point of view, to step back and set one's ego aside. Developing these capacities is critical to being able to recognize where, when, and what we owe to one another. The moral importance of being an acceptor and sharer of responsibility carries over to our shared political life. If being an acceptor and a sharer of responsibility displays a person's skills as a moral agent and the virtues she has developed, being an evader of responsibility at least a serial evader, is generally a sign of moral pathology. This is evident in former President Trump's failure ever to accept responsibility for his actions. Most importantly, for the death and destruction resulting from the insurrection he incited at the Capitol on January 6th. In more ordinary cases of evasion, the evader exhibits not a character disorder, but certainly character flaws. When persons evade, they put their own reputation, position, and feelings ahead of the persons they have wronged or harmed. And when they fail to share responsibility with those for whose acts they bear ultimate responsibility, they may show a lack of courage and of generosity and charity toward them. In either case, though especially the former, they fail to be sufficiently mindful that they are just one among others, neither more nor less valuable. The same is true of failures to conciliate, especially when advancing important moral values requires it. Both failures to conciliate and failures to take or share responsibility erode the conditions needed for fair resolution of our conflicts and for efforts to advance beneficial policies. When winning or one-upping takes priority over problem solving, when, to borrow from Lincoln's wording, the men take priority over the cause, our moral and political lives are diminished. The Lincoln virtues are a bulwark against such diminishment. But they are not valuable only in our lives as citizens and as members of a moral and political community. They are also good for us. There is clear prudential value, I'm suggesting, in cultivating these virtues, and not only for instrumental reasons, or so it seems to me. It can be difficult to accept and even to share responsibility in the ways Lincoln did. Doing so renders us vulnerable. We become targets of others' blame. We may suffer reputational loss, but more deeply, doing so may require us to confront unpleasant truths about who we are and what we've done. Accepting responsibility may be jolting insofar as the person who harmed or wronged another and ought to accept responsibility doesn't square with our sense of the person we are. We commonly feel profound embarrassment and shame when we recognize our responsibility for wronging another, at least in cases where the wrong or harm was substantial. And these emotions may motivate us to duck it. Given the painful feelings and potential blow to our reputation and self-image, how can it be good for us to accept responsibility in cases in which we can get away without doing it? And how can it be good for us to share responsibility when we are at best the ultimate authors of what was done, when we can simply leave the blame where it landed? Why not duck or pass the buck? The virtues Lincoln exemplified have great instrumental value in helping a person to live a flourishing life. For one thing, both the skills and capacities one must develop in order to cultivate them and the virtues themselves have broad application, equipping us to formulate and effectively pursue what Rawls described as our plans of life, and more generally, to achieve what we tend to value in life. Much of what we value concerns our relations with others, our family, friends, colleagues, neighbors, lovers. Critical to developing and sustaining satisfying relationships over time are those capacities that enable us to be well-functioning moral agents, capacities for sympathy, honesty and self-honesty, self-reflection, care, and respect. We sometimes describe those with whom we forge our closest relationships as the people who have our backs. And part of having someone's back is not letting them take the full blame when we ourselves are directly or indirectly, wholly or partially responsible. Our ability to pursue our projects and careers depends on our relationships with others who may not be so near and dear, indeed, who may be total strangers. And so it too will require these skills and be enhanced by these virtues. The instrumental benefits of these skills and virtues include their impact on a person's moral learning and moral development. Learning how to listen to criticism defensively enables a person to take in criticism in a way that is not disabling, affording opportunities for the acquisition of self-knowledge and thereby for self-improvement. Learning how to see things charitably from another's point of view enables a person to learn to deliver needed correction in a way that is not disabling to another, affording her opportunities for the acquisition of self-knowledge and thereby self-improvement. But the benefits of being and making oneself into someone animated by the generosity, the charity Lincoln displayed in his dealings with others go beyond these instrumental ones. They concern the internal condition of the person who so orients herself, someone who reliably and appropriately accepts and shares responsibility, who seeks to conciliate when the stakes are important, even at some cost to herself. Having a generous spirit in dealing with others and with oneself is empowering. The skills one must develop in cultivating it, the self-honesty and sensitivity, the appreciation of one's place among others, can be a source of stability and inner strength. None of what I have said should be taken to deny the prudential value of a limited, narrowly confined self-deception. Thinking that you are more attractive than you are may be a good thing, insofar as it boosts confidence, enables you to better navigate social interactions, just as thinking your child especially lovable tends to be good for your child, insofar as it may make you more responsive to your child's needs and solicitous of her well-being. Nor should it be taken to deny that in particular cases, a person may benefit more, at least in the short term, and perhaps even sometimes in the long term, from evading responsibility rather than accepting it or sharing it, from refusing to conciliate. On balance, however, I'm inclined to think that possessing the relevant virtues and being well-functioning moral agents more generally is good for us. Of course, not everyone is up to the challenge of cultivating the skills and virtues explored herein. Some of us may have a psychological makeup or the kind of upbringing that better equips us to develop them than others. Whether this is because of an individual's own makeup or because of fortunate parenting is simply one more illustration of the fact that goodness is a gift. It is one of the things that moral luck or the natural lottery provides, as was the case with Lincoln, or withholds, as is the case with Trump. The luck of being morally good is surely the deepest kind of moral luck. Still, as with a great many other things, like being a good golfer or ballet dancer, it takes more than fortunate genetics and good parenting to become a skilled moral agent. The skills we must have and the virtues we must develop can be cultivated, more or less, with practice, and can certainly be improved with it. Becoming comfortable with accepting responsibility, with conciliating, with being generous in our dealings with others, even when they irritate us or hurt us, is connected to being comfortable with who we are. Interestingly, both Truman and Lincoln were underestimated by many of their contemporaries. In particular, Lincoln, the self-taught rail splitter from Illinois, was initially scorned, as noted earlier, even by many of those whom he ultimately appointed to his cabinet, his team of rivals. Indeed, in his first encounter with Stanton, when Lincoln was a lawyer riding the circuit, he was met with rather rude disregard. But among those who got to know him, including Stanton, and even among most of his rivals, their disrespect gave way to near reverence. This is wholly unsurprising. Although we can't all develop the skills and virtues Lincoln exhibited, and no doubt Lincoln himself fell short, although we cannot all achieve his excellence and his beloved status, we can become better at it, more comfortable with who we are, and more generous in our dealings with others. Thank you. Thank you.